kind of blew their mind why an Alaskan would come down to Wisconsin, La Crosse, Wisconsin, of all places, to have surgery done.
Alaskans seek better deals on surgeries in the lower 48. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, August 14th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Fairbanks School District gets into the software business.
Alaska doesn't have a lot of school districts that are engaged in any kind of marketing activity. We are a pioneer.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Kinnick Arm Bridge will create 1,500 jobs during the 4 years of construction and spur thousands more after completion by creating access to affordable land for commercial, industrial, and residential use. For facts on the Kinnick Arm Bridge, visit kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
A Hawaii-based utility is applying for a federal permit to import liquefied natural gas. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, it's unlikely to encourage development in Alaska anytime soon.
Hawaii Gas submitted its application to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission last week. Hawaii has a law requiring at least 40% of its energy come from renewable sources by 2030, and it sees natural gas as a bridge to get there.
Got to figure if it's being shipped out of California, the gas is coming from Lower 48 somewhere.
Larry Persley is the federal coordinator for the Alaska Natural Gas Transportation Projects. That's an agency that oversees how natural gas will be shipped around the state. Persley says Hawaii Gas's application does not specify where the gas will be sourced from, but it will set sail from the port of Long Beach. That port is ready for vessels, with 40-foot tanks filled with natural gas. The application, Persley says, indicates the first phase of the project is quite small, and the gas could come from tiny operators that can truck the LNG to the port in Southern California.
Getting these small shipments from Alaska is not feasible, not an issue, never under consideration.
The project will not increase demand for Alaska's natural gas just yet, but the application says that in the project's final stage, LNG could come from multiple sources, requiring large receiving terminals. That could be good for Alaska. Until then, Persley says the project could increase the public perception of natural gas, and that could eventually benefit the state too. A representative from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission says the agency will open the first comment period on the project as early as this week, but a ruling won't come for at least a year. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Alaska has some of the highest health care costs in the country, and employers in the state are starting to encourage their health care plan members to seek care in the lower 48 for some of the most expensive surgeries and procedures. The companies say the savings are significant and hope the practice puts pressure on prices in the Alaska healthcare market. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Last spring, Chris Spencer needed a total knee replacement. There are plenty of orthopedic surgeons in Anchorage who could have done the surgery, but instead, Spencer flew to La Crosse, Wisconsin.
It kind of blew their mind why an Alaskan would come down to Wisconsin, La Crosse, Wisconsin, of all places, to have surgery done.
The answer to that why question is really very simple. The knee surgery was cheaper in Wisconsin, a lot cheaper. Spencer is vice president of finance for United Utilities Incorporated, a subsidiary of GCI. The company has been offering a travel benefit for its health plan members since 2011, and this year GCI followed suit. GCI and United Utilities contract with a medical tourism company called Bridge Health Medical to implement the service. Spencer says the experience was phenomenal.
Being the finance person, I realized the savings and then also realized the quality was just incredible. So it was more, not just monetary, but there were also other reasons, you know, just the quality of the surgery and the place and the people and so on.
Bridge Health flew Spencer and his wife to Wisconsin in first class. They had a hotel for the week and a care coordinator who attended to every detail of the travel and surgery. Even with those costs added in, Spencer's surgery outside saved his company $14,000. Kathy Carr is vice president for human resources at GCI. She says GCI spends more than $1,000 per month insuring each employee.
We are year after year looking for ways to curtail those rising healthcare costs, but do it in a way that's beneficial to our employees, so it's a win-win for all of us. And Bridge Health just seemed to be a logical choice to offer to our employees.
GCI isn't the only company encouraging employees to go outside for some surgeries. Premera Blue Cross Blue Shield will start offering a travel option for some plans starting early next year. And the state of Alaska is working to expand the travel benefit it already has in place to make it more appealing to employees. The plan used to only cover airfare for outside surgeries and procedures. Now hotel and car rental will be offered too if the total cost is lower than it would be in Alaska. Becky Hultberg is the state's commissioner of administration. She stresses it will be optional for employees, but says cost containment is driving the change.
Our health care costs for the state of Alaska are more than doubling every decade. And that's just a completely unsustainable trend for any large organization.
The department's analysis shows physician fees for certain surgeries are substantially higher in Alaska than the lower 48. The surgeon's fee for carpal tunnel surgery, for example, is about $1,000 in Seattle, $4,000 in Juneau, and $4,600 in Anchorage. That does not include additional fees to pay for the hospital, anesthesiologist, and other services that add up quickly. Hultberg wants doctors in Alaska to be successful, but she says healthcare consumers and providers in the state need to have an important conversation.
The question is really, how much more is it acceptable for us to pay? Should we pay 150% more, 200% more, 300% more? And I think as more and more employers say that the difference right now is too great, that they can save a significant amount of money by going outside, that will have a positive effect on the local market.
Hultberg understands it will always cost more to do business in Alaska. And Anchorage orthopedic surgeon David McGuire says that cost difference does increase healthcare fees in Alaska. He also points out the state is an isolated small market and says that drives costs higher. And he's not worried about the trend of more Alaskans seeking care outside.
Doesn't trouble me at all. Go for it. At the end of the day, we have patients that are going to Singapore. We have patients that are going to Mexico. We have patients that are going anywhere. I have patients from Boston and from Los Angeles and so on because they know that I can do certain things that they can't get done where they are. So in the end, what it seems to me is that people ought to be free to go wherever they want to go.
United Utilities employee Chris Spencer says the pain in his new knee is minimal compared to what he used to deal with. And he's already scheduled surgery to do a total knee replacement on his other knee. He says he didn't think twice about where to have the second surgery done. He's heading back to Wisconsin. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Chinese law enforcement has taken custody of a pirate fishing vessel. The Coast Guard cutter Rush intercepted the Da Chang just over 2 weeks ago in the North Pacific Ocean near Japan. The Rush crew found 30 metric tons of albacore tuna and 6 metric tons of shark and shark fin on board. They'd been using illegal high seas drift nets, which are banned by international treaty. Chief Petty Officer Kip Wadlow says the Da Chang crew insisted their 177-foot ship was flagged in Indonesia. That turned out to be a lie.
Once Indonesia refuted their claim, the vessel was determined stateless, and that is when we started to work with our other Pacific partners to determine what the final fate of this vessel would be.
Wadlow says the Rush crew stayed with the Da Chang for 2 weeks while the Pacific nations hammered out an agreement. The Coast Guard kept up their investigation and found that 26 of the 27 gill netters are Chinese. One is Taiwanese. The Coast Guard also realized there wasn't enough fuel in the Da Chang to carry it back to the U.S. Two Chinese fishery law enforcement vessels took custody of the Da Chang. They're escorting the pirate ship to a Chinese port where the crew will be prosecuted. Wadlow says the Da Chang's crew was in good health when they were picked up, but it's not clear if they were working on the vessel voluntarily. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a setback for a promising venture selling Alaskan potatoes to China.
If they're only willing to get seed potatoes from Alaska, what kind of an opportunity is that for Alaska? I mean, in my mind, that is huge.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
The Fairbanks North Star Borough School District is in the software business. The school board approved a licensing agreement Tuesday with two district employees who developed AppTrack, a program for managing Apple devices and applications. School District Attorney Jim DeWitt outlined the fundamentals of the agreement with staff members Kevin Henveld and Mark LaFoon.
The creators will receive 10% each, total of 20% of gross revenue. The balance of 80% of the revenue will come to the district. Expenses that are incurred in marketing the software will come out of a district's pocket. We control that.
DeWitt said the district is an authorized developer for Apple and has already licensed and copyrighted the AppTrack program. He says the district is treading new ground with the business venture.
Alaska doesn't have a lot of school districts that are engaged in any kind of marketing activity. We are a pioneer.
DeWitt urged school board approval of the licensing agreement, saying copyright protection is tenuous and the creators could easily develop a modified version and go off on their own.
It doesn't take much at all to create that new product to move beyond the copyrighted interest of a software.
School board members felt pressured to approve the agreement despite a warning from Assistant Borough Attorney Jill Dolan that state statute does not explicitly empower the district to engage in a license agreement. Members Silver Cord and Wendy Dominique voted against it. In comments preceding the vote, Dominique expressed trepidation.
I have not got a satisfactory answer where I feel that going forward with this will make this district any richer by getting revenues of 80% and paying out to employees that were paid a salary with benefits already to do the innovative things that they have done.
The school district estimates it spent $10,000 to develop AppTrack, a program it says could have cost $200,000 to buy if another entity did. Member Sharon McConnell reluctantly voted for the license agreement, saying the business deal raises concerns.
You know, if we're going to pay extra compensation or go into the agreements with these employees, you know, down the road, how many more folks are we going to have to do that with? Nonprofit, government entity, whatever we are, going into a for-profit business. That's a concern for me also.
Other school board members were enthusiastic about AppTrack. Board President Christina Brophy pointed to the program as something to be proud of.
Hearing things like, well, Apple's interested in it. You know, all these other districts are interested in, you know, what we have as a product. I think we should take a moment at least to recognize that we had a couple of individuals that did something pretty amazing in our district.
Another board member, Sue Hall, was also supportive, singling out the software venture's financial potential.
I think it's a smart move for us to go ahead and pursue this, enabling the district to gain revenue from a source other than the public treasury.
It's unclear how much money selling the AppTrack program will bring the district. The smallest package, which includes licenses for 25 Apple devices, sells for $500 with an annual renewal fee of $165. The district will also offer AppTrack tech support and training contracts. China is importing Alaska-grown seed potatoes, and some state agricultural officials have hoped for a seed potato industry to sprout in the Delta area and the Matanuska Valley. But a state audit indicates that it is not to be. As KSK's Ellen Lockyer reports, Alaska is not producing enough spuds to meet demand, while other factors have put a damper on a seedling industry.
A state audit may have put the kibosh on what could have been a new market for Alaska potatoes. Alaska potatoes are virus-free, and that's one thing that makes them desirable to Asian buyers. Bryce Wrigley, president of the Alaska Farm Bureau, says that presents a big opportunity for Alaska growers.
Alaska is the only place in the world, to my knowledge, that is allowed to sell seed potatoes to China and to Taiwan. When you look at that, you see tremendous opportunity. China is the world's largest potato producer and the world's largest potato consumer. And so if they're only willing to get seed potatoes from Alaska, what kind of an opportunity is that for Alaska? I mean, in my mind, that is huge.
The state audit conducted earlier this year by the Division of Legislative Audit disagrees with that assessment. The audit suggests that the seed potato industry will not flourish because it takes more than one element to sustain an entire industry. Juanita Ayers is director of the Division of Economic Development.
It also takes working internally in Alaska to make sure that the farmers that might be growing for that market are aligned and working in unison to meet the demand. And it takes some additional infrastructure with regard to storage facilities and handling facilities so that the product can move to market and be transported out of Alaska.
Ayers says the state has spent money on a testing program for seed potatoes, $5.5 million since 1994, with only a return of $250,000 to $750,000, according to the audit. Ayers says the audit concludes that a seed potato industry would not result in profits and would barely pay costs.
The phytosanitary testing that is required, which is largely what this funding has gone for, is just one part of the equation. And I believe that that's really the difficulty of creating a viable project is that the funding has never been sufficient to cover all of those arenas. It's really supported this testing activity to the exclusion of some of the other development work that needed to happen.
Wrigley says the amount of money spent on the seed potato project is minuscule when compared to, say, the oil industry. And he says seed potatoes could be $1 billion a year industry for the state.
I'm not talking about $1 billion in sales. I'm talking about $1 billion in economic activity generated from the turnover of those dollars staying in Alaska and in the economy working. The economic activity is what I'm looking at.
What export of seed potatoes that has taken place has been done through an Idaho dealer who arranged with the buyer in China. Ayers says that relationship has fallen apart, and Wrigley confirms that potatoes shipped in 2010 were not paid for. The Idaho grower contracted with Delta and Matanuska seed potato growers to fill his orders. Wrigley says the Idaho contractor paid the Alaska farmers. Ayers says the federal government recognizes the growing of seed potatoes as a manufacturing process, and state money was spent on the potato program through the Alaska Manufacturing Extension Partnership. AMET may understand the audit's results as the end of the seed potato program, but Wrigley says restructuring is a better solution.
The audit is non-binding. The legislature can go ahead and do that. However, they're going to look at that and seriously consider, okay, what are we getting for our money? The only argument is, what is the value of that project to the state? You know, is there a value there, and is it worth continuing to spend some money and then looking at, okay, how do we need to restructure this so that it does look better?
Ayers says that the seed potato program is flawed because it has relied on only one buyer, one whose plans for large-scale potato growing in China did not pan out. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
A local judge in Dillingham is considering bringing grand jury trials to the community. KDLG's Ariel Van Cleve explains.
Alaska Superior Court Judge Patricia Douglas hosted an informal meeting to get input from the community about the possibility of holding grand jury trials in this area rather than in Anchorage. The function of grand jury trials is to decide whether there is enough evidence to actually charge a person with a crime. Those juries only hear from the prosecutor and witnesses, and the proceedings are kept secret. Grand juries usually consist of 18 people, while trial juries typically have 6 or 12 sitting jurors, depending on the type of crime committed. Judge Douglas says this initial meeting with the community is only the beginning of a longer process to decide if this is a viable option.
It doesn't hurt to kind of sit down and let's think about these things. Do we want to keep doing them this way, or is there something that would be more helpful to us? And in talking with a lot of other judges and a lot of other folks, they said, have you talked to the people in the community? And I said, well, you know, on a casual basis, as I see people and things come up, and I said, well, you know, you should really think about having some meetings and just let people come. And that kind of, the idea kind of developed that maybe we could have regular coffee courthouses sort of meetings and, you know, just let people feel comfortable coming to the courthouse.
The reaction from a few of the dozen people who attended the meeting was not exactly positive. Some of the issues raised were the high cost of flying in and housing people from the region to participate in the trial, the actual size of the jury pool, concerns about having a fair trial, and pulling people away from fishing or other jobs. The way the system works now, district attorneys present a lump of cases from this area to grand juries in Anchorage in a condensed time period. Assistant District Attorney Anne-Marie Garber says in the past she's presented cases to as many as 15 grand juries in the span of 3 days. Current rules require a grand jury trial 10 days after a person is arrested and taken into custody, but that deadline is not always met in rural Alaska, so it's often the case that charges are dropped to misdemeanors while they wait for the grand jury's decision. Judge Douglas says holding these trials in Dillingham could prevent what she calls a logjam. She says another benefit would be expanding the jury pool, which could include villages within 50 miles of Dillingham.
So truly, the only time they come to the courthouse most of the time is if something bad's happened. A brother, a son, a daughter has been charged with something and they're sitting at the defense table. And that's not a good way to be introduced to the courthouse, you know. And so that's one thought, is that, you know, maybe some of these villages that had not participated in the system as jurors before, if they had were included, that then they'd get a different perspective on what the legal system really is all about and how it serves the people.
She says this move could also pave the way to have a true jury of peers. She says she's concerned courts in Anchorage may not truly understand the lifestyle of rural Alaskans. Alaska Bar Association President Hannah Siebold also attended the meeting. She says the organization is concerned with what she calls access to justice.
And making sure that the entire demographics is represented. And so finding that balance of making sure that the jurors are peers of those. But at this point, we're more listening than we are doing anything else. And it's not that we would necessarily have a say in how the court system spends their money.
There are still more conversations to be had before any decisions are made. Judge Douglas had mentioned possibly having meetings every 3 to 4 months. In Dillingham, I'm Ariel Van Cleve.
The historic Yates Building in downtown Ketchikan is one step closer to restoration. A nonprofit that works to preserve historic properties in the city and the Episcopal Diocese of Alaska signed a memorandum of understanding to move forward in seeing if rehabilitation is possible. KRBD's Sarah Chiksa has the story.
Looking at the white, brightly painted wooden siding and aluminum roof on the building next to St. John's Episcopal Church on Mission Street, you wouldn't guess it was over 100 years old. But the now unused and boarded up Arthur Yates Memorial Hospital building turned 107 this year, a year it almost faced demolition. The Yates building may be saved, thanks to the Memorandum of Understanding that was signed between the building's owners, the Episcopal Diocese of Alaska, and those seeking to restore it, historic Ketchikan. St. John's Episcopal Church Reverend David Yaw says the Memorandum of Understanding simply means both parties have agreed to work together in good faith.
At this point, matters are very plastic, and there's not a whole lot of really solid parameters other than the fact that the building will not be sold, and the property would not be sold, and that the final decision, of course, must come from the bishop and the standing committee of the diocese.
Historic Ketchikan now can move forward with a feasibility study to see if the building is worth restoring, beginning with a grant application for state funding. Historic Ketchikan Executive Director Dave Kiefer hopes to not just save the building, but find an economically beneficial long-term use for it.
There's two tricky parts to this whole process. One is the renovation, and we've estimated, just preliminary, that you're looking at a cost of somewhere between $500,000 and $600,000 to renovate. Then part two of that is, what's it going to be? Because if there's no future use, the building will die again. And so that's actually in some ways might be a harder part of the process than simply fixing the building up.
What makes the building so special besides, well, its age?
First of all, there are very few buildings in town from that time period. There's only like three or four. Second of all, it hasn't really been appreciably changed in that time period. Most buildings in Ketchikan have been changed a lot over the years. You know, it hasn't. If you look at the old photographs from 1904, 1910, 1929, basically the Yates building looks pretty much the same as it's always looked. That's really rare in the historic preservation world.
The building has been home to many. It was built in 1904 to be a hospital. In 1941, after a period of vacancy, it became home to the Alaska Sportsman Magazine and Specialty Shop. The Ketchikan Chamber of Commerce moved in 1968, occupying the building for about 10 years. The church then operated a Siemens Center in the building during the 80s, and it's been largely vacant and near demolition since then. While the building has been saved from demolition, at least for a little while, Kiefer says this is a significant opportunity for a city that wants to market itself as a heritage tourism destination.
The building and the history of Ketchikan deserve one really good sustained effort. Because once it's gone, you know, you can put up all the pictures you want and say, there used to be this great old historic building here, but who cares? That's not history.
Applying for funding for the initial feasibility survey and discussions with the community on potential building tenants and uses are next on the agenda for Historic Ketchikan. And since the Yates Building has just a couple of years left before rehabilitation becomes unfeasible, its preservation is now a priority. In Ketchikan, I'm Sarah Chicksaw.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Ariel Van Cleve in Dillingham, and Sarah Chicksaw in Ketchikan. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Doyon Limited, celebrating 40 years as Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Check the status of your permanent fund dividend application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for contributing to a college savings plan and to add or change charitable donations. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. For thousands of years, the coastal residents of Arctic Alaska have depended on the polar bear for sustenance, utilitarian, and spiritual purposes. The Alaska Nanook Commission was formed to ensure that current and future Alaska Native subsistence hunters will be able to continue to harvest this important resource. The Alaska Nanook Commission, along with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, would like to hear from subsistence polar bear hunters. Learn more at alaskanannookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.